Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
No, listen to me. Listen to me. You got the wrong guy here. You understand?
I got right guy.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Eagles suck.
And I've since spoken to sports radio DJs, and I was like, you must have gotten those calls where it's clear the guy is reading from a script. Like, absolutely. And it was the same guy every week. We'd make time for this person. And Rob said, I just wondered, what is that person's life like in the 23 hours and 58 minutes that he's not on the radio reading his little thing?
Welcome to That Scene with me, Dan Patrick, an Amazon original podcast where I get to talk to Hollywood's top actors and directors about some of the most iconic scenes that have defined their careers, helped shape the cinematic landscape, and even become fixtures in pop culture. On today's show, we're joined by comedian, actor, and screenwriter Patton Oswalt. Patton was born in Portsmouth, Virginia, 1969. He was 19 when he started performing stand-up, and in 1999 received his own HBO stand-up special. Patton began writing for Mad TV and started picking up supporting roles in films and TV shows like King of Queens and Down Periscope. He received his first starring role in the 2007 Pixar animated film Ratatouille. In 2009, Patton starred in the dark comedy film Big Fan. The movie follows Paul, an obsessive New York Giants fan, as he descends into madness. Big Fan was shot on a shoestring budget of $5 million and filmed entirely on location in Staten Island. Patton won an Emmy for his 2016 comedy special, Talking for Clapping. He currently plays Principal Durbin in Peacock's AP Bio and plays MODOK in the Hulu series with the same title. The scene in question comes at the end of Big Fan when Paul has cornered his rival, Philadelphia Phil, in a bathroom stall and promptly lights him up with a paintball gun. You've got the paintball gun and you're firing away at Michael Rapaport.
Yeah. Yep.
How much glee did you take out of that?
I mean, look, there is that feeling of, and I'm sure you've dealt with them too, internet trolls, where you're like, oh, if I could just, I don't want to kill them, but it would be nice to terrify them, if only for 5 or 10 seconds. That would feel pretty good.
Whoa, what are you doing? I'm taking... Hey, what are you doing, man? Don't do that. No, don't.
Quiet, okay? You didn't have to be mean.
What are you talking about, mean?
Everybody's always so mean.
I felt that way about Rappaport, doing that to Rappaport himself.
How perfectly cast was he?
Yes.
I mean, look, he is that guy. He was perfect.
But what was it about him that set you off, that you wanted to just humiliate him in the bathroom stall?
It's not when he's being mean to me, because I think Paul is used to that. I think Paul is used to people making fun of him. It's when he extends the olive branch and says, you come up here, I'll buy your first Yuengling, you can become a Philadelphia fan. That, to me, is you've gone too far. How dare you? You can make fun of me, but you cannot pity me, and you cannot try to save me, which implies that my team sucks. That's when my brain gets cracked, and I've decided, okay, I have to take this guy down now.
But how much Zen is in Paul?
I think it's Zen by default. If you reject the world in favor of simply one thing, then you will have Zen on some level, but it's Zen at such a massive price. Zen should come from you still being able to live in the world and interact with people. Zen shouldn't come at the cost of being a human being. You know, someone who just follows Star Trek or Lord of the Rings or Rick and Morty, and that's their whole life, they have a level of Zen, but it's a very, very damaged Zen. It's an evil form of Zen.
How much of you is in Paul?
There's no sports in me, but that same getting wound up about my passions, it's the same spark. It's just different fuel. I never really make fun of sports fans because how are they different from me getting all wound up about the latest Marvel Comics movie and how they portrayed a certain character, or how, like, it's the same thing. It's just you link to a different realm so that you feel bigger in the world. And I think everybody does that on some level or another. I think some religion exists on that level, you know?
Yeah, the fandom, where it comes from, if you're not a fan, but as you're saying, I don't have to be a sports fan to have fandom for something that I truly care about.
Exactly. Everyone has that one way or the other. Whether they want to admit it or not, everyone has a link to this bigger realm. The trick is to find a healthy way to do it. You know what I mean? How do you turn that into something healthy and positive in your life and in the world?
The last scene is dark.
Oh, boy.
But it's funny. How did you see it when you first saw that?
I saw it, and I said this to the director, and he didn't even realize this, is if you notice, all throughout the film, pretty much the only way he communicates with the outside world is over a telephone. And he has one friend, Kevin Corrigan. And I speak with Kevin Corrigan face to face. And in the last scene, I'm talking to my best friend over a phone now. That's how I communicate with him. And I've become, in a way, purely what I wanted to be. I am absolutely cut off from the world. And they're holding up the schedule of my team to the glass. And I'm looking at it. And that's all I have to interact with anymore.
Oh, man.
What?
New England, December 20th. I get out that week.
Oh, shit.
Patsies are toast. There's no way we're losing with us in the parking lot.
Not a chance.
15-1.
Totally realistic.
Oh, man. It's gonna be a great year.
When did you first hear about Big Fan?
Well, I first heard about it. My agent sent me the script. And it had been going around Hollywood for many, many years at that point. The guy that wrote it was an editor of The Onion, and he wrote the screenplay for The Wrestler. And The Wrestler got all this heat and all these awards, and it gave him the money and the wherewithal to go, this is the script I want to make. I want to make it the way I want to make it. I want to direct it. And it was all low-budge, SAG. We had no dressing rooms. We had nothing. We had nothing. It was absolutely the way you heard like movies would get made in the early 70s when people would just show up and go, what do we have here? What can we borrow? We don't have any money. I remember talking to Rob about where did this character come from? And he said he would listen to sports radio for years. And I've since spoken to sports radio DJs and I was like, you must have gotten those calls where it's clear the guy is reading from a script. Like, absolutely. And it was the same guy every week. We'd make time for this person to call in, and Rob said, I just wondered, what is that person's life like in the 23 hours and 58 minutes that he's not on the radio reading his little thing? And that's where he built that thing about, you know, that's where the story came from.
Let's go to my boy Paul in Staten Island. He always brings the leverage. What's on your mind, brother?
Hey, sports dog, how you doing? I'm just calling to say, I can't wait for this Sunday when we finally shut these Philly clowns up once and for all. I can't tell you how sick I am of Philadelphia Phil and all these cheesesteak bozos going on about Brian Westbrook this and how we can't stop their passing game. We've been talking smack all week on this show. Get out your forks because you're going to be eating your words big time.
I love his passion. Thanks, Paul. Yeah,
thanks, sports dog. You're the man.
I'm wondering, though, Pat, now, having a low budget, like your life in the movie is low budget.
Mm.
But in your world, you don't have a lot going on in your life.
No. And it definitely fit into the look of the movie because we couldn't build sets. We couldn't, like, we had to film in people's homes. We had to film, you know, the very cheap rig on a very cheap car. Yeah, you're right. This guy is basically hanging on by his fingernails. And the one, I guess, kind of pure thing that he does, although it's also psychotic, is he is actively trying to carve everything out of his life except for the team that he loves. You could argue that, well, I mean, he's also rejecting a lot of materialism and a lot of gross capitalism stuff, but that's just incidental to him aggressively not living a life. He's just not living a life because he is devoted to his team.
But there's moments of observational humor because when your character puts his button-down shirt on yeah. to make the announcement on talk radio, Paul doesn't realize how pathetic he is.
No. I feel like, in a way, he pities other people and thinks that they're pathetic because they're clogging their lives with spouses and children and travel when you should be focused on this amazing, there's this amazing team and you guys are ignoring it, or other people are watching the game and then it's like, and then these idiots go on and do other things instead of dwelling on the game all week. How do people live that way? Like, I think that's literally how he thinks.
How would you describe your relationship with your mom in Big Fan?
Oh, man. That actress, Marsha Jean Kurtz, who you will remember as, she's one of the bank tellers in Dog Day Afternoon. She was also in Panic in Needle Park. She is this incredible actress. The first scene that we did together where she's in the kitchen and she's putting the soy sauce and duck sauce packets into the packet drawer, which is what you do.
Of course.
And she's being really, really quiet and kind of, and I was like, huh, she doesn't seem like she's in this scene.
It's a real riot, not being wasteful.
You know what's a riot? Is you spending 20 years collecting all these sauce packets that you're never going to use.
You need help.
Mm. And you need 6,000 egg rolls to put all that stuff on.
Then the next thing we did was where she's screaming at me from her bed when I come in, when I'm yelling at her. And I almost started crying because she was so raw. And when I rewatched that scene and I rewatched the movie, what I realized was, you know, Marsha read the script and what she figured out was that mom is terrified of him. She's scared of Paul. When you watch how she acts in the packet drawer scene, she's scared of me. And when she's screaming at me, she's almost like, I can't take this anymore. Even if this guy kills me, I just want to end this. She's so incredible. So I think the relationship is that she's terrified of me. And the tragedy is that because I'm so cut off to the world, I don't see how people react to me and interact with me. So I don't realize how frightened she is of me.
Where do you get dressed if you don't have a dressing room?
In the backs of cars. Someone else's car that they drove to the set. I think I changed in the back of Kevin Corrigan's car. Or at the end of the shooting day, they give you the next day's wardrobe and they ask you to change in your hotel room before you get to set. So there was a lot of that going on.
You know, because this is supposed to be a glamorous business. And here you are. You got a small budget and you're getting dressed in back of somebody's car. Do you go, am I doing the right thing? Is this what I want to do?
You know, weirdly enough, doing Big Fan was because I'm such a movie nerd, and because it was so close to when you the way you hear stories about how they shot Easy Rider or The Rain People or Five Easy Pieces, where it really was, you know, just seat of the pants. That was one of the few times I felt like this is what I should be doing. It's when a lot of times it's when I'm doing the big budget movies and I'm sitting there against a green screen and I'm like, wait, what am I doing here? Like, I mean, look, if you want to see people question their career choices, look at Ewan McGregor's face in the Star Wars prequels when he realizes, wait a minute, I'm in a warehouse in Marin County against a green blanket and there's a guy holding a tennis ball at the end of a pool cue going, this is Jar Jar's face, so just talk at this level. And he's like, I studied Shakespeare for a decade. What the hell am I doing? You know, that's where someone's questioning their career.
That's a great point because, I mean, this is gritty and it's meant to be gritty.
Yeah.
It plays into the feel, like the movie looks gritty.
Yes. And you know what was great? We filmed completely on Staten Island, except for the scene where I go into the city when I follow Quantrell. Everything else was shot in homes on Staten Island and in actual businesses that were amazing. The food, the restaurants and stuff on Staten Island are incredible. Like, it's really, really good ethnic family-owned restaurants with just incredible cuisine. And we tried to capture that. And there's been a couple of reviews I read from more hipster or maybe New York-based or artier publications saying, this is such a sneering, punching down look at Staten Island, you know. But then people that I've met from Staten Island are like, that's exactly what Staten Island is like. You actually got it right. You actually shot on Staten Island, and that's what it's like to live there. And we're being criticized for looking down on Staten Island by people that you realize would never set foot in Staten Island. So that was really interesting to see that dichotomy.
My wife's from Staten Island.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
What part did she grow up in?
Great Kills, I think.
Yep. We shot around there.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of Staten Island there.
Yeah. Anthony Bourdain did a whole episode where he went with, Buster Poindexter, David Johansen, to Staten Island and embraced their amazing food that's out there and the amazing culture. It's pretty incredible.
I remember David Johansen. You know, I saw New York Dolls.
Where? When?
Well, I'm old. I'm 65.
Oh, my God. What, did you see them in New York?
Yeah. And I don't even remember. You know, it's one of those that I got to see so many bands when I was growing up. And then somebody said, you know, do you remember when we saw Iggy Pop? And I go, did we see Iggy Pop? And they're like, yeah, remember? He was yelling at the crowd and then he cut himself and then people were throwing shit at him. And I go, really? And then somebody brought up New York Dolls. And I had the album.
Oh, yeah.
I was always fascinated with the New York Dolls, and I don't know why.
Well, then, in a way, you lived an authentic 70s New York experience if you don't quite remember. If you had remembered it, then I would go, then you weren't actually enjoying it the way you're supposed to be enjoying it. But if you're like, there's a blur, I kind of remember television, yeah. I remember the talking heads, and I think the New York, you're like, yeah, he was definitely there. Yeah, that's how you're supposed to remember that stuff.
Is this your taxi driver with humor?
Yeah. In fact, on set, I kept calling the movie Fatsy Driver. I was just like, it's Taxi Driver without the push-ups. That's all it is.
Travis Dickhole.
Travis Dickhole. Travis Quarter Pounder with extra pickles. That's who I was. Look, that's an ongoing thing, especially I think people that first grew up in the 70s and how awful New York was, and now with social media, there are just Travis Bickles over and over again, that there are always stories about people that can't quite connect. And it's nothing new. If you read Willa Cather's Paul's Case, that's basically about a turn of the century Travis Bickle. And there's always been those people that can't connect, but they're human beings too. And they're out there and they're in pain. It's that last line of Roger Ebert's review of Taxi Driver, the original review, which is, we don't notice people like Travis Bickle, but he's there and he's suffering.
Was your character suffering?
I think, yes. What he was suffering was the fact that the world existed. I think what he would have been happy is if the world could vanish and it could just be him enjoying these games. One thing I put in it was when he's around other people, he's either bristling or his head is down and he is shut off. Like when he's at his brother's house and they're showing his ad for his law firm, you know, my head is just down and I'm shoveling cake in my mouth. How can I anesthetize myself with flour and sugar? And then when I'm in the strip club and the stripper sits on my lap asking for a lap dance, it looks like I'm crawling out of my skin because she's in the way of me looking at Quantrell.
But how do you get into that character? How do you know what that character is?
I was like, what if I really fed my worst impulses and let them metastasize? And what if I was just, let me watch movies, don't talk to me, let me sit and read my books, let me read my comics. I don't want to, like, if I, on my worst day, what if my worst days was my normal operating procedure? And you just kind of get into that mindset. I stayed in a very, very cheap hotel on Staten Island that was not very aesthetically pleasing. There's that great Oscar Wilde quote when they ask him, why are Americans so violent? He goes, because you guys have such ugly wallpaper, which is funny, but there's something true there. Like, if you just look at drabness and ugliness all day, it changes your mood after a while, you know? And so I let this bad hotel I was staying in, and also the fact that I'm staying on Staten Island during the grossest part of the winter, I let that affect my mood, and it really helped. I just got right into it, you know?
How quickly do you wait for reviews to come out of Big Fan? How important is that to you at that time in your career?
I like reading reviews, even if it's bad, because a lot of times a really well-written review, even if it's negative, what they'll do is they're like, couldn't the movie have done this instead? Or why didn't it reach for that? So I think anyone who tells you, I don't read my reviews, A, they're lying. Everyone does read their reviews. You want your work to go well. And you also want to see, like, this little thing, this personal thing that I put in there, did they catch this? Did they see this thing that I was going for? And it's interesting to see how things get translated that way.
Is there Paul in all of us?
Yes. Look, if you want to ask if there's Paul in all of us, look at the fights that happen every day on Twitter now. I mean, if anything, I think Twitter revealed that there's a Paul Alfiero, unfortunately, in all of us. Some people feed it. Some people wink at it. Some people manage it. But yeah, it's there.
Comedy or drama tougher for you?
I mean, drama is tougher for the emotional sustain, take to take, scene to scene. Comedy is tougher because something that you think is so brilliant when you're shooting it, and then when you watch it, and it does not work, you know, despite how great you felt about doing it. And then at the same time, there's something that you do as a throwaway line that you didn't even think was going to be a big thing, and it becomes massive. And you're like, I can't believe that became a thing.
Has that happened to you on stage?
Oh, God. There was a whole bit that I worked on for years about differences between religion and why religion caught on, and I never got it to work. And then I finally did, and I thought there'd be a whole, that this whole other part of it would be funny about how we kind of use religion to trick people into a reward in the afterlife. And the line that gets quoted to me all the time is a throwaway line going, "Sky cake, why are you so delicious?" Which I thought was like, well, not even a punchline. And that's the thing that gets quoted to me all the time. I was like, well, you know what? I can't control it.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What kind of sports fan are you?
It's weird. I don't follow day-to-day sports. I don't really follow a season or a team. But as far as sports documentaries are, 30 for 30 documentaries, the stories of the personalities, the Michael Jordan series that was on Netflix, that stuff is endlessly fascinating to me.
Why?
Because I think even more than in music, in film, in literature, the kind of personalities and the kind of functional psychosis that you need to succeed in sports is so profound and fascinating. It's these people that really are living kind of at the edge of, I don't want to say like human experience, but especially in terms of psychological experience, they have to sort of think of themselves as gods or demigods in order to succeed at what they do. I mean, if you look at the Michael Jordan documentary, the thing that made him so amazing in sports is kind of what makes him a train wreck as a human being, because he doesn't think of himself in human terms, but that is an advantage for him entering that arena and having to compete.
Like Michael Jordan in The Last Dance is about relationships or the lack thereof. It's not just about greatness on a basketball floor.
Yeah. You know, if you think of any endeavor, putting together an album, running a presidential campaign, running a school, it is the same thing in terms of I've got to balance all of these different personalities that might not actually get along, but maybe in the moment, they're exactly what we need. Running a massive police investigation, if you read Gangland by Howard Blum, the team that took down John Gotti, that was not a group of personalities that agreed with each other, but they were perfect for that task of taking him down.
Because I go back to Rudy. Rudy is not about football.
Right.
Hoosiers is not about basketball. I mean, you can run down this whole list of what we consider sports movies, but that that connection or lack thereof is always what fascinates me. The 86 Mets have a documentary coming out.
Yeah.
A gang of misfits, but you piece it together and the pieces fit, at least for that 1 year.
Well, did you read the book Bad Guys Win?
Yeah.
Don't they take a plane trip at one point and they're so hammered on the plane that they're almost destroying the plane while they're on it? Like, they're maniacs, but they were the maniacs that we needed to win that season. Is this going to be a documentary or a docudrama?
With the Mets?
Yeah.
I think it's a documentary. I think they go back and they interview a lot of the characters. You got Dykstra and you got Hernandez and Strawberry and Gooden. Gary Carter's not with us any longer. Ray Knight, Davey Johnson not with us. But I covered that team.
Wow.
And that's one of those where you never knew what you were getting when you went to the stadium.
That was kind of a running motif in the early 80s, where a lot of teams that, like, I'm amazed no one's done an in-depth documentary or drama film about the early 80s Redskins, where basically that was a complete band of weirdos and misfits. You had John Riggins, who was a friggin' maniac, and then you had Art Monk. Art Monk, who was this super genius, like, watching game films over and over again. He had his hit list of people he wanted to take down. Then he had, like, Joe Jacoby, who's basically the Thing. He's like the Thing. Like, he just go out there. I don't think his nerve endings worked anymore. He would just be smashing through people. It was this weird Suicide Squad superhero team that won the Super Bowl.
Well, you had Theismann and his ego.
Oh, God.
You had the very religious coach and Coach Gibbs.
Yep.
I mean, that was a fascinating team. Dexter Manley was on that team.
Yes, that's right. I remember Dexter Manley being on morning radio in D.C. I was growing up in Northern Virginia, and he would go on the Grease Man, and it was like 6 in the morning. And I think he was in this weird, I don't want to, well, he was in a cocaine haze where he's like, I don't need to sleep. I can do everything. And so you'd hear him at 6 in the morning on the radio, but then he's like, you have a game today. What are you doing? Just no sleep, just craziness.
But Phil Simms tells a story that one morning his wife goes, Lawrence is in the garage, and it was Lawrence Taylor. And he goes out, he goes, what do you need, Lawrence? He goes, I need your golf clubs. And he hadn't been to bed, but he needed some golf clubs. And he stopped off at Phil Simms' house before he was going out to play golf.
That was the world of the early 80s.
Oh, I know.
But again, all of the stuff that people talk about how crazy music was during these years. Look at how insane filmmaking was and insane how politics was. Sports was just as insane with the same extreme personalities just slamming into each other. The games were exciting enough. And then a decade later, when you watch the documentary about what was happening, you're like, I had no idea. I mean, I figured it was crazy. I didn't think it was that crazy.
Do you get to choose your name in AP bio? Ralph, like Principal Ralph Durbin.
No, that was the name in the script, and I loved it. It sounds so like this beaten down, like, yes. He's showing up. He's trying. Who's the he's an NBA coach, but he has the most beaten down, droopy dog look. He's a good coach.
Oh, Greg Popovich.
Not Popovich. There was another one.
Jeff Van Gundy.
That's the name. Jeff Van Gundy's a terrific coach, but if you look at him, he looks like he's always just watched his puppy get run over by a bus. Like, that's his face. Just like, oh, God. That kind of energy of Ralph Durbin. He's an authority figure with no actual authority that no one actually listens to. But things succeed despite of him. It's something kind of cool.
You really don't know what this is about, do you? Morning announcements were my chance to be the cool guy, to connect with the students, and you took them from me.
Oh, Ralph, why would I ever do anything to hurt you? You pulled me up from the gutter. You're an amazing man. I would never take the announcements from you.
Well, it's too late. I'm awake now, Helen. I thought I had this game cornered, and then you came in and did it in a way that I didn't know was possible. I'm a fraud. No. You should do them.
Oh, I should do them. You think that's what people want? Me running around like a big dumb goof? I do that crap for my nephew, and he's 5. Forever, if you know what I mean.
Holy crap, is that thing on?
Weirdly enough, with Ralph Durbin, I kind of get in touch with those days, which is most days for me, when you want to do good in the world. I don't want to contribute to an evil business. I don't want to perpetuate stuff that hurts the environment, but it feels so massive. And you get that feeling sometimes where you're like, I just took a bag of recycling out. What good have I just done? Like, or you feel like later on I'm going to do something that's just as wasteful and it'll totally negate what I've just tried to do. And so it's just that kind of, I'm trying, but deep down I know I'm not actually doing anything here. And I think we all feel that.
Can you go to the set in a good mood? Like, is it tougher to make the transition? And then when you get done with your scene and you go home, you know, you got to kind of snap out of Principal Durbin, the Charlie Brown of principals here.
Well, I go to the set in such a good mood because I love the people that I get to work with. I get to do most of my scenes with Paul Appel and Glenn Howerton, and they're friggin' geniuses. The only time I get sad when I'm on a set is when I'm doing material that I don't think is good or I don't think is interesting. When people say, this movie is really sad, I don't know if I'm going to watch it. The only movies that make me sad are badly made movies. A movie that's really well made, even if it's gut-wrenching, I eventually become happy because somebody made a beautiful piece of work. So yeah, I'm going to work and I'm acting like a sad sack and I'm getting beaten down, but the lines I get to do are so funny and the work I get to do is so good that I show up in a good mood and I go home in a great mood. I'm like, oh my God, I did the coolest stuff today.
Who was the character in Ghost? The really tall guy?
Vincent Schiavelli.
Yes. Like, Van Gundy is a shorter version, it feels like, of him. Because it always looked like he was sad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Vincent has that gorgeous face. I think he has Marfan syndrome. But it actually makes him kind of beautiful because his eyes have this really real sadness. And even in those scenes when he's going, get off my train, you can see how much pain he's in.
Yeah.
He's always one of those great presences in films. He spoke fluent Italian, and over in Italy, he had a cooking show on Italian TV. He would just cook food. Like, he just was this really happy guy, apparently.
Was he also in Fast Times?
Yes, he was the guy that goes, I just switched from regular to Sanka.
Yeah.
He was also in Better Off Dead as the math teacher that the kids are really into, and he ends up dating the main guy's girlfriend. And he's also in Buckaroo Banzai. He plays Christopher Lloyd's henchman. So yeah, he's been in everything. He's great.
Do you know the history of cinema that well that I can throw out random characters here, Pat? I mean, it's very impressive. People are going to think we scripted this, where I go, and then I'm going to bring up, and then you do your research.
Well, look, is it any different than, I'm sure when you talk to your friends, you can recall a tight end who played one season for the Kansas City Chiefs and he didn't get the shake he was allowed. And like, it's the same thing with movie freaks going, this guy, this actor should have been, like, our brains are wired to different exotic informations.
If you're flipping through and you see this actor that you stop, not necessarily the movie or the show.
Well, Paul Giamatti, I'll pretty much watch in anything. Helen Mirren is always doing something fascinating. Cate Blanchett can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned. A guy named, oh my God, I was just talking about him to a friend.
Jeff Van Gundy.
Jeff.
When all else fails, just yell out Jeff Van Gundy.
The movie that I just saw that I can't believe I missed last year is a Dutch film called Riders of Justice. And it starts off like every Liam Neeson movie you have ever seen. Guy's family gets blown up, and you're like, oh, he's an ex-Special Forces Ranger. He's going to go on a campaign of revenge. And it goes in directions that you do not see coming. Still has plenty of violence and action, but it becomes this weird character study of the group that's trying to get the revenge on the bag. I don't want to spoil it. It's one of the best films I've seen in the last 10 years. It's called Riders of Justice. You'll love it. You will absolutely love it.
Why is it Liam Neeson? He's cornered the market on these movies now. And like, did you see the Snowplow one?
Oh my God. What was it called?
Cold Pursuit. But the weapon is a snowplow.
Hell yeah. Why not? Come on. They should have called that movie Liam Neeson with a Snowplow. Just give it that title. I would have totally seen it. Look, he does a movie where he fights wolves with little broken airline bottles of booze in the snow. I mean, come on. And I think half the time he reads his scripts, and if he laughs out loud, he's like, well, I got to do this one. This is going to be hilarious.
You'd never let him watch your kids, by the way.
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, wouldn't he be the guy that would...
No, they always get put in trouble, though.
Well, that's, yeah, there was a whole trope back in the 90s, never be Harrison Ford's family in a 90s movie, because all they do is get kidnapped and threatened.
I think that's what happening right now.
Try not to be Liam Neeson's kids in a movie.
Any plot twist in the fourth season of AP Bio?
I don't want to spoil this, but there is an episode where basically the students decide to start shipping all the faculty. Well, that means they're writing fiction where they're all hooking up. And as the thing goes on, after a while, you don't know what's real and fake after a while. It is one of the most psychotic episodes they have ever written, and they write some really weird ones. That one's amazing. There's also one that involves a tornado, and watch it, and you'll see where it goes from there.
And you're officially a superhero, is that right?
I'm a supervillain. I'm MODOK on Hulu's show, MODOK. And by the way, speaking, we were talking about obscure characters, and MODOK is the equivalent of that player that you and all your sports nerd friends know that never got the shake that he got or he deserved. So we decided to make a whole show about the most obscure and ridiculous Marvel villain. And he hates all the Marvel heroes, but he equally hates all the villains because they don't give him the respect that he deserves. Because he's a gigantic floating head with these tiny little arms and legs.
But who is he?
Well, MODOK is an acronym for Mobile Organism Designed Only for Killing. And he was this loser schlub that was put through an experiment that made him a super genius, also made his head gigantic. The group that made him was going to control him. He rebelled against them, destroyed all of them, and now he's his own man and he's going to rule the world. But he's also struggling to have a family and children because his argument is these other supervillains, Dr. Doom and Kang and the Green Goblin, they've got to sacrifice everything to rule the world. I will have both. I am superior. I can rule the world and also have a loving family and kids that respect me. He's so damaged. Well, don't you want to know why I'm hacking into S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yes, of course. Sorry. Yeah, I haven't been sleeping well. My phantom limb pain's been
I'm hacking into S.H.I.E.L.D. to take back the time machine I invented and they stole. Don't you want to know why I need the time machine?
I'm sorry. It's hard to concentrate. Now, I've been on a lot of antidepressants since I lost my favorite arm.
Oh, my God. Gary, keep your personal life out of the office. I'm going to use the time machine to fix my marriage by taking my wife to a Third Eye Blind concert from 17 years ago. Then she'll remember how things used to be between us. A time before I felt comfortable enough to fart in our marital bed and at her father's deathbed and at his wake and during the entirety of her tearful eulogy.
Can we get that to the big screen?
There's 10 episodes on Hulu right now, and if we could get MODOK on the big screen, it would be amazing. It should happen. He's such a beloved character.
Patton, thank you. I've always been a big fan.
No pun intended.
I've always been a short fan of yours, and I just want to say thanks for your time.
Dude, thanks for having me on, man.
Thank you, buddy.
Talk to you soon.
New episodes of That Scene are available exclusively on Amazon Music. And all of Season 1 is available wherever you get your podcasts. So make sure you follow us in the Amazon Music app. That Scene with Dan Patrick, created, hosted, produced by me. Our showrunner and producer is Brendan Pike, edited by Nathan Moody. The show is executive produced by Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood. Our associate producers, Bill Ryan and Marvin Prince. That Scene is an Amazon original and a production of Dan Patrick Productions.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.